we're all good to go.
Thanks very much. So my involvement with Peninsula Bay, the site itself, goes back to prior to Variation 15. Variation 15, to the proposed district plan at that point, I was involved on behalf of the QLDC. It goes by the QLDC to give advice about Variation 15. And that went through a council level process and then went to Environment Court and ultimately resulted in that Environment Court decision that we've talked a little bit about. Then, at the time of Variation 25, I was again engaged by the council to give advice on Variation 25, and that went through to a council level hearing, and it was decided that council level would not appeals after that. After that, there was a plan change 40, which was a plan change which just corrected some issues to do with mapping in Peninsula Bay, and that was decided at council level. It was a fairly brief plan change process for that. It was quite a discrete set of issues for that. And then plan change 51. Now, in plan change 51, I've been engaged by the requester, obviously, and have started work on that probably 2 years ago, I suppose, maybe two and a bit. And a lot of my work, time-wise, a lot of my work was giving advice about the design stages of the project and working through a lot of different iterations of the design and examining layouts and building envelope heights and shapes and a great deal of work on that sort of thing to end up the design we've currently got. So a lot of my involvement was to do with design advice on that front, and then produced a landscape assessment report that was part of the application for the NOFI plan change, and then evidence for today. So what I thought I'd do, commissioners, was just take through my evidence very briefly, just skip through. Obviously, there's some bits that it sounds like you'd like to know more about, so I might read some bits, and then at the end you can take me to whatever you want to take me to. So firstly, well, in paragraph 6 of my evidence brief, I talk about my report and summarise the outcomes of my report, but at paragraph 7 there I go through some of the history of the site and these various plan changes it's been through. So I thought I might read out the points of paragraph 7 because I think some of them sound like a little bit of a clarification. So first bullet point there, prior to 2004, the area that is now Peninsula Bay low density residential zone was rural general zone. In 2004, proposed variation 15 sought to rezone the land for residential development. Proposed variation 15 was ultimately examined and decided by the Environment Court. I was the QLDC's landscape witness in those proceedings. The details of what was proposed by variation 15 evolved as it went through the application and hearing process. By the time of the final iteration of variation 15, the QLDC and myself as a witness supported a configuration of development that included a number of individually located house sites in the northern area that is now open space zone. Of course, it wasn't at that point. Including 11 house sites within what is now identified as the outstanding natural landscape. For a number of reasons, not all related to landscape and amenity, the court found that the purpose of the RMA would best be served by rejecting variation 15, and hence Peninsula Bay remained in its rural general zoning. That was the outcome of that decision. So an important finding of the Environment Court's decision regarding variation 15 is that it identified the extent of the outstanding natural landscape that includes Lake Wanaka. The court heard extensive evidence on the issue from three landscape witnesses, and there was considerable cross-examination on the matter of this landscape line. Landscape categorisation within any district must be done on a very large scale. All three landscape witnesses involved in the Variation 15 proceedings effectively agreed that two landscapes meet in the vicinity of Peninsula Bay, one being the dramatic landscape of Lake Wanaka in its immediate context, and the other being the pastoral land that surrounds Wanaka. The court found that the very northern part of the Peninsula Bay site is within the outstanding natural landscape that includes Lake Wanaka, and that most of the Peninsula Bay land, which at the time was pastoral land with rural general zoning, was part of the visual amenity landscape that took in the rural land surrounding Wanaka town. It also found that the southern boundary of the outstanding natural landscape, the RML line, follows the crest of a rounded ridge line that runs roughly east-west across the Peninsula Bay site. And this O&L line is shown in orange on Appendix 1. Now, why I'm at it, the Commissioners, Appendix 1 to my evidence was supposed to be the concept scheme plan, but in actual fact what's attached is the landscape plan. Sorry about that, it's supposed to be the concept scheme plan. So if you look at the concept scheme plan, you'll see the orange line, which is the O&L line. Now that line was the line that was decided upon by the court in the Variation 15 decision. Now, as we've heard, the Variation 15 decision didn't actually attach a map to it, which makes it a bit confusing, but it described in words where the line was. And that line really came from the evidence of one of the landscape witnesses, Di Lucas. And interestingly, reading Ann Stevens' evidence this morning, Ann Stevens worked with Di Lucas to produce that evidence at the time. And so the orange line was the line that the court went with, largely on the basis of Ms. Lucas' evidence. And then after that, when Variation 25 came along, various plans were produced showing where the landscape line is. And it was shown where the orange line is shown in that plan. So at the time of the Variation 25 proceedings, although no plan had been drawn by the court, everyone used that line as the O&L line. Nobody said you've drawn it in the wrong place, so that's not correct. That's the line that all the parties agreed was the O&L line. Also, of course, we've heard this morning, correctly, for some reason or other, that line's not drawn on Appendix 8 of the district plan as it's operative. The idea of Appendix 8 is that it's updated as environment court decisions find landscape lines, and they're drawn on that appendix, but for some reason or another, that line doesn't appear on Appendix 8. So then if we move on to my third bullet point there, in late 2005 and 2006, Plan Change 25 was proposed by the QODC to put in place the zoning that's now in the plan. I was engaged by the QODC to provide advice in relation to landscape and amenity issues. In relation to the relevant northern area of Peninsula Bay, Plan Change 25 proposed some low-density residential zoning extending northwards to touch the O&L line. No specific dwelling locations or design controls were proposed. Development that would have been enabled would be the same as development within any low-density residential zone in the district, which was 700 metre minimum lot size and 7 or 8 metre high buildings, depending on gradient. Obviously, this type of development is quite different to what would be enabled under the current proposal. The visual assessment work that was undertaken at that time suggested that the northernmost areas of the proposed low-density residential zone could adversely affect views from the north. My advice was that this area of proposed low-density residential zoning should therefore be excluded from the rezoning, and ultimately this advice was followed such that the current zoning configuration of the plan was put in place. So then, with reference to the history provided above, I note the following in respect to the proposed Plan Change 51 development configuration. At this point, I'm talking about the as-notified configuration. It's changed the beginning. Firstly, building platforms within lots 4 to 6 and 20 to 22 are located within the activity area 5A development areas that were proposed by Variation 15 and were supported by the QLDC, including myself and the witness. So, prior to lunch, I think you were handed a structure plan for Variation 15. And if we look at the northern end of the Peninsula Bay site, we can see there's a big area which is called Activity Area 5B. And then there's little blobs within that called Activity Area 5A. Now, 5B was open space, 5A were house sites. So then the strip of lots to the north of the existing low-density residential zone, proposed lots 1 to 3, 7 to 19, and 23 to 26 of the current proposal, are very largely located within Activity Area 1, a development area that was proposed by Variation 15 and was supported by a QLDC, including myself and others. So again on that plan you can see AA1. Now that was more or less a low-density residential zone, that activity. Then currently proposed lots 1 to 3 and 7 to 16 are largely located within the part of the low density residential zone proposed by Plan Change 25 that I advised against and which was ultimately deleted. The current proposal, however, includes specific measures, reduced density, maximum building heights and new areas of protected vegetation to ensure the built form will only be very minimally visible from the north. The zoning proposed by Plan Change 25 did not include those measures. So that's that sort of background history section, commissioners. Moving on from there, I summarise my report, and then at paragraph 11, I come to landscape amenity issues raised by the submissioners. I don't propose to read any of this out, commissioners. My paragraph 13, I list in bullet points the issues that have come out of the evidence to do with landscape. And then in the paragraphs after 13, I deal with those various issues. I'm happy to answer questions about all that, but I didn't intend to go to it. And then skipping right over to my paragraph 51, this is where I address issues raised by Dr. Marion Reed's report. And again, in 51, I list in bullet points there the issues that have come from Dr. Reed's report. And so the next part of my evidence, I go through those. And if I skip right over to my conclusion, perhaps, commissioners, that's quite a good sum up of where I'm at. So I might read through there. Firstly, I'll just talk about my assessment report, and then paragraph 85 from the Plan Change 51. 4,200 square metres of private residential lots may exist within the identified outstanding natural landscape that's under PC 51. Only one dwelling would be enabled within the outstanding natural landscape, and that's the lot for building platform. And this is in an area capable of absorbing such change. But both the provisions of the operative and proposed district plans do not seek to entirely exclude development from the OML. I consider that the development enabled by Plan Change 51 will sit well with the provisions of the operative and proposed district plan in relation to urban expansion and district-wide issues. An area that is within the urban growth boundary and that is immediately adjacent to existing urban development will have residential development enabled on it. A carefully designed edge between the urban and rural environments will be evident, and the most open, sensitive and valued parts of the outstanding natural landscape will remain in their current state. Effects on both landscape character and visual amenity have been well mitigated by the proposed design. A small part of the development enabled by Plan Change 51 will encroach onto the outstanding natural landscape. Section 6B of the Act states that protection of outstanding natural landscapes from inappropriate subdivision use and development is a matter of national importance. I understand that the overall assessment of whether the proposed subdivision use and development are appropriate or inappropriate must be done in a way that considers matters that are outside my area of expertise. However, related to landscape matters, I consider that Plan Change 51 will not diminish the relevant outstanding natural landscape or reasonable purpose of such data. Overall, I consider that the northern end of Peninsula Bay is a vicinity that requires careful treatment. Plan Change 51 responds very well, and that important views from the north will be very minimally affected in the sense that open and displayed north-facing slopes will remain in their current relatively natural state, and it's my view that PC 51 can be supported for landscape. So happy to answer any questions or not questions.
Sure. Yeah, I'll just to start off, I guess. Read through Ms. Stevens' evidence. One of the points she makes is that, in her mind at least, that the Environment Court had determined the line considered the ONL in the context of visibility from Lake Wanaka being part of the Lake Wanaka feature as being one of the factors why they stopped at the ridge line. What she seems to be saying is if you look at that, the third photograph on the right, the very top, she seems to have effectively drawn the line around the extent of the Kanuka plantation. In the absence of Lake Wanaka, could that land exist as an ONL in its own right? Or is it dependent, irrespective of where the landscape line might be drawn, is it dependent on its relationship with Lake Wanaka?
Well, I think it's dependent on something to the north being ONL. this case it's Lake Monaco, if it was some pristine area of forest or something, you'd come to a point at the south where you have to draw the edge of it. Mm. And the Variation 15 proceedings examined that, not just in the context of Lake Monaco itself, obviously, but they were dealing with the whole landscape categorisation issue, and where do we draw these lines in the district plan. And so the examination that happened at that stage found, and all the witnesses agreed, that, well, the land that runs away to the south from here is a separate landscape. It's a landscape that at that stage was really a pastoral landscape, or at least was an agricultural landscape. Now it's more or less a suburban landscape. So the issue of where you draw that southern edge was the issue that was examined, and ultimately it was decided to be following this the crest of this rounded moraine line of hills. So to me, yeah, that's the place to draw it. That's where one landscape turns into the other landscape.
Ms. Stevens seems, and we'll ask her the same thing, but she seems to be suggesting that the land on the southern side of the line, down towards the base of the terrace, which is also Kahuka clad, has the same characteristics as the part that is within the allow, and therefore should have the same classification. So you disagree with that, obviously, based on
I would disagree with that, in that part of the area to the south of the orange line has the same characteristics as the original wall. It sort of diminishes as you move south, obviously, in that there's less vegetation, there's more exotic grass. But the real exercise is when you're categorising these landscapes on a very large scale, there are always going to be pockets of very natural vegetation or very natural character in a landscape that's not Moman Hill. It doesn't mean you should draw a blob around it and call it Moman Hill. The real exercise is to draw the line between two landscapes. And the experience of being on the flat land that surrounds Wanaka is the experience that you have south of the orange line. The experience of being in a very natural exposed landscape that includes Lake Wanaka is the experience that you have north of that line. So that's why the line is where it is.
Thank you, that's helpful.
I asked earlier in the day the factors that were taken into account in the environment court decision, PC 15. I mean, are they the same as what's you'd take into account today if you were, a fresh piece of planning to be done on the site?
Well, the short answer is yes, they are. I think the factors that are in the operative district plan at that part I talked about earlier this morning.
Appendix 10.
The assessment matters of Part 5. They talk about the landscape categorisation process and how it should be done, and then how to apply the assessment matters.
Right.
So there's a section there that talks about how to categorise landscapes, basically. And there's a list of factors there that it says you should take into account. And there are a list of factors that were known as the Pigeon Bay factors, Pigeon Bay criteria. And that list of factors came about through a case in Banks Peninsula District, as it was then. And perhaps interestingly, they really came from the Dilucas evidence in the Banks Peninsula case. And they were sort of accepted as a useful set of factors to be considered when categorising landscapes. And so they went into the district plan in this district. And they went into the district plan in this district before Variation 15.
Right.
So they've always been in the district plan from then on. So they were the factors that were considered then, and they're the factors that are still in the operative plan. And really they're the factors that are still used today. They've been refined quite a bit and made a bit clearer and a bit less woolly. There's the more recent Environment Court decision is on Plan Change 13 in the Mackenzie District, which refines those and makes them clearer, and they're sometimes called the Mackenzie criteria now. But they're essentially the same. They're certainly the same ones that were used at the time of Variation 15 as the ones that are in the operative plan now.
So if we were to apply those criteria to the this area that's in dispute, what criteria, I don't have them in front of me, but yeah, I mean, does it fall foul of not meeting the couple of the criteria or all of them? Or?
Well, it's They're not so much a list of criteria as a list of matters to be considered.
Matters to be considered, yeah.
So, and in a way, you can break them down into natural patterns and processes, ecology, geomorphology, hydrology, this sort of thing, and human patterns and processes, i.e. how modified the land is, what development patterns have gone on. And they, like I say, they were the factors that were used at the time of the court decision regarding where the landscape line is. And so I don't think you'd do anything differently today.
Right. I guess I was just sort of following on the previous questions from the Commissioner about the difference between this I keep on thinking it's a southern facing slope, it's not really as the north is up the plain here, so it's sort of west, is that right? West facing?
Well, the land, the orange line there really marks a change between land that slopes to the north and land that slopes to the south.
Yes. I mean, that's the sort of the difference though, isn't it? So what you're saying is that because of the northern, it's got a different relationship. It's a different sort of landscape unit or whatever you might call it from the... That's the key reason.
Essentially, that's the break line, if you like, between the two landscapes. There's a landscape that rolls away to the south that isn't particularly outstanding. It's, it's flatter and it's...
Yes.
What have you. And then there's this landscape that rolls away to the north that is.
Right. I think it was in Dr. Reed's evidence. Talked about the sticky forest, which is the pine-covered hills, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where the line, I think, takes a more sort of inland route.
Well, that line that she talks about there is purely her line. It's not in the district plan or anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, setting aside where that line was, I mean, I guess there was... part of the issue being, well, this thing needs to join with other outstanding natural landscape lines, and there's no point sort of materially, you know, having dog legs or cuttings or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's again, the line that's shown, is shown there and came through from the court, does that logically, you know, if that to be extended north and south, does that logically fit in with something, does it?
Well, yes, I'd say it does. I mean, I haven't examined the sticky forest area in any detail. It's a bit more difficult because, of course, it's covered in this exotic forest.
Yeah.
So does that mean you exclude the whole lot from the ONL or not? But in any event, this line, if you continue that orange line to the north, you'd have to move it around to get it to the right spot.
Yes.
But there is a line there that, again, marks the north-facing land that falls away to the lake from the south-facing land or the western-facing land.
Yeah.
So... if we accept this line as the line that was decided upon by the court, and then the next exercise is where does it go to the north? Yeah, I'd imagine that could be done quite logically. I mean, I haven't done it, but I'm sure it could be done.
Without fundamentally altering where this line goes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. With the one lot that is proposed now in the ONL line, that lot's 4, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the factors that the district plan has within it about development within the ONL, can you just the operative provisions, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So is that what we'd find on, like, you've got page 18 there? Operative district plan provisions 425.
Yes, paragraph 18-19.
18-19.
Paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah, starting at paragraph 18.
Sorry, yes, that's the one here.
Yeah, so those ones that I quote there in paragraph 19, 4.2.52, that's the district-wide policy to deal with outstanding natural landscapes. And then in paragraph 20, the ones I quote there, those are the proposed district plan policies.
Right, so those are the proposed ones.
Those are the proposed ones, yeah.
They'll put them aside, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so looking at that policy 4.2.52, outstanding natural landscapes.
Right.
Obviously,
Yeah, I just wonder if you could step through them for us, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, well, there's a desire to preserve openness, and that's that policy really came about. These policies came about through a lot of environment court proceedings in 1999, 2000 that were setting the provisions of the plan at that point, setting references to do with the district plan. And the preservation of openness really came about through the observation that most of the outstanding natural landscapes of the district, if you look at it by area, are these open mountain faces and tussock-covered land that doesn't have high vegetation, so it's very open and wild and what have you. So therefore, the preservation of openness of the outstanding natural landscapes was an important factor. Then, moving on down, there was this... The policy identifies areas with little or no capacity to absorb change, and then if we go to point C, allow limited subdivision and development in those areas with higher potential to absorb change. So the policy set up this regime, if you like, whereby inside an outstanding natural landscape, it's possible to identify areas that can absorb change and other areas don't have the capacity to absorb change. So the policy really sets out the practice that you should identify areas that are able to absorb change, and if any development's going to go up in the R&L, that's where it should go. And then we come down to the importance of protecting naturalness and enhancing amenity values of views from public roads, because again, public roads were considered to be particularly important as they passed through the R&L, so that's where that policy came from. So, you know, if we think about what's happening here, and there's this building platform proposed in the R&L, on that area of Lot 4, if I read those policies together, that's the sort of development in an O&L that the plan is directing us towards.
Because it's got this ability to absorb.
It's got this ability to absorb. It's not. Obviously, if you look at the O&Ls by area, they're massive parts of the district, and a lot of them are very widely displayed and open and things like that. So to me, this is exactly the sort of pocket that they're talking about in this policy.
Right. Yes. So, while B talks about avoidance, that's related, though, to the landscape with little or no capacity to absorb change. So that's the part of it.
Yes, those parts of.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's helpful. The part of the site which is towards the south, and it's got more the Kānuka cover over it rather than the more open sort of area. It appears to me that it's still got some sort of, it's still got, okay, it may not be an outstanding natural landscape, I guess that's still where we're going to land and work out where that line is. But even if you say we accept the outstanding natural landscape line as being shown where the orange line is, it still appears to me that land has still got some landscape and visual amenity associated with it.
Yep, I'd agree with that.
Yes.
If we look down towards proposed lots 13, 14, 15 up to 19, that sort of area, these are south facing slopes that look in towards the existing suburb.
Yeah.
But they do have a lot of remnant Kānuka still on them. So yeah, I'd agree with that. In particular, they provide visual amenity to that very northern part of the peninsula suburb.
And that, I think, there's a bit of revegetation proposed through that area, but it's more, it doesn't really replace that loss of that natural character. Oh, that's slow.
Yes. I agree. That's really what I'm sort of saying in part of my assessment to do with landscape character. If we look at the specific area over which the change will occur, the character of that area will change from open, unused land with Kānuka on it to suburban development. So I think there's definitely a character change happening there down by lots 13 to 19. But what I'm saying really is that as far as the landscape character change occurs, that character change will be a substantial change, but it'll be quite localised. And in terms of visual effects, the people of the northernmost parts of the existing suburb on Infinity Drive there, they'll certainly experience an adverse effect there. But again, it's fairly localised.
Right. Do you think it's that localised? I mean, can you be that sort of definitive?
Well, I guess, you know, often when we're dealing with the developments in ONLs or even not in ONLs but in sensitive landscapes, you know, we're talking about, we're considering the scale of the effect and because of the topography of this district, often we're talking about often very long distance views and quite a broad visual catchment that these things may be experienced from, whereas in that context, this is really quite confined. Mm.
Can't remember what, again, where it was raised, but I think someone was saying, well, it does sort of create a sort of a useful sort of full stop or backdrop to the urban form, the urban development in that area.
Yes, well, again, I come back to this probably similar to the ONL line, in that there is this rounded hill landform at that end, and I think if development spilled over that, then you'd be losing that containment. Sort of, you'd be losing that sort of booking-type edge. But to take development up those hills, up those south-facing slopes towards it, but not breach it, I don't think you lose that containment.
Right. So you don't think those lots, 24, you know, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, which is sort of close to the top?
Yeah, that's right. Close to the top. But not
on it, yeah.
Not beyond it, and also in relation to 20, 21, 22, and 23, 24, an important, very important part of the design process that we went through there was getting the floor level, the maximum height level of this building envelope set just right, so that they look to the west, they look to the southwest, they don't look to the north. So they're looking over the existing development and beyond to the lake, they get great aspect.
Yes.
But there's no creep over the top,
no, pull over the top. Just wanted to clarify a little bit, while you were just thinking through that history, which was helpful, of the different plan changes and things that have been looked at. Well, first up, paragraph 7, it's the first Roman numeral, little 1. This is plan change 15. Just had in there a number of individually located house sites in the northern area. There just wasn't a number with that. You told us the number of, it was 11, I think, within the NOL.
Yeah.
Well, is there a number? I mean, that's probably not germane, but I was just sort of, you know, was it hundreds or tens or, you know, fives?
Well, there was 11 in the ONL,
yeah,
and then to the south of the ONL, I'd have to look at it. There wasn't a specific number. There was just a zoning and
density. Oh, just a zoning, okay.
So,
yes.
But it wouldn't have been. Yeah, I'd have to look at it. It certainly wouldn't be hundreds. It would have been, you know, maybe 30.
I don't think it would be hundreds either. I just had a question mark there saying, well, I wonder how much was. So I talk from paragraph the number 3, where you're talking about the 2005 variation 25. So it seems to me there. So what are you saying that your concern there was because it just applied to zoning the part of this land and didn't have the controls around building heights, for example, that we're looking at now, the revegetation, all those sort of things. Was that the issue? Was it? It was sort of just a sort of a, if your bank had zoned it, then, you know, warning bells went off or something.
Well, sort of. Yeah. Basically speaking, if a blanket low-density residential zone extended all the way to the north to that orange line, then it would allow one house per 700 square metres and it would be allowed to be up to 8 metres high.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine, looking at our plan here, if you can imagine lots 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, if each of those lots had, say, two or three houses on it and they were all 8 metres high, that was creating quite an effect as viewed from the north. You'd have seen built forms sticking up above the ridge from the lake quite plainly. So that was the effect, really, that, that resulted in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That light big scotch.
But hence, then, your support for this more nuanced or whatever you might call it, current plan change 51.
Yeah, I mean, the houses in that area, for a start, they're pulled back from the I-Never line.
Yeah.
They move to the south. They're on those south-facing slopes. There's less of them, and there's a much lower height plane.
Right.
The height plane's probably the determinant part, because the height plane on those lots, 7-12, is such that you can't see them from the north at all.
Yes.
They have no effect on the
north.
So that's the big difference.
Right. And so, am I right then understanding then, hence the open space zoning which has been applied for that thing through Plan Change 25, what's your understanding of why the open space zoning then was applied to that land?
Well, at the time of Plan Change 25, the guts of the plan change was to create low density residential zones.
Yes.
And then it was going to be left over.
Yeah.
There was a bit of an argument, as I said, about where the edge should be. Originally, Plan Change 25 proposed low density residential zone right up to that O&L line.
Yeah.
Then that was pulled back. And so there was this leftover bit. And as I understand it, Plan Change 25 was the first instance in which open space zone was put in the district plan at all. Why it was open space zone, or why it wasn't just rural general zone, O&L, or something like that?
Yeah.
Was it possibly a holding pattern to get it across to council and reserve?
Yes, I couldn't say anything. Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess, was trying to work out. Yeah, is it a holding pattern? Oh, no, there's a landscape value there. Maybe it's not O&L, but there's something worth keeping there as open space rather than built form. Or is it, again, sort of just a, well, not quite sure what to do with it. Let's just put it back in space, because that's what everyone can agree with at the moment.
Yes, I couldn't help them much more than that.
Right. Yeah, I'm wondering if it would be useful. I mean, presumably, Plan Change 25, there is a decision report or some sort of, you know, analysis of it. I think it would be useful, helpful for us to understand that context.
Sure.
Yeah.
Certainly at the time, as I say, it was really to create low density residential zone, and then there was the leftover bit.
Yeah.
It was envisaged that the leftover bit wouldn't have development.
Yes.
So maybe that's why it went to that zone.
One more question, just about the in the plan change material itself, and the words, there's reference to sort of reflectivity, I think, and cladding and those sort of things. And I think there's a proposed addition about colour hues, brown, green, and something other. Or...
Yes.
I guess if it comes to, this is all hypothetical, of course, if it does get approved, that's all hypothetical, of course, at this stage, but I just wanted to sort of just, I guess, the practicality of some of those rules or how they might be sort of interpreted or applied. I mean, it's kind of a general statement about brown and greens and, you know.
Yes, well, that provision, I'm just trying to find where
it's.
Yeah. That wording actually has come from existing wording.
Oh, okay. Natural greens, browns and greys. Yeah.
Yes. Within the range of natural greens, browns and greys. So that's the part that's been added on relatively recently. It was always proposed to have this reflectivity value 35% or less.
Yeah.
And so Dr. Reed raised the issue that, well, you can actually comply with that reflectivity rating but still have an unusual colour. Which is actually correct, you can do. So that wording has been added on within the range of naturals, greens, browns and greys. The reason that wording was chosen is because that's one that's already in the, it's already used quite a lot. I'm not sure exactly what part of the plan it's going to, but it's taken from the existing provision.
Right. Does the exterior cladding include the roof?
Yes. Yeah.
I was wondering, have you have a natural green paint colour? I mean, not really a natural colour at the start, is it? It's
well,
of manufactured colour, isn't it? But,
within the range of natural greens, browns and greys.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know.
Okay.
Didn't have a couple of questions? Just a couple of questions.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the properties that are significantly affected are the ones on the northern side of the Trinity Drive. Mm. And I presume that the further back you go up towards Minnery Ridge, the upper part of Infinity Drive, that visual effect diminishes because you're not looking directly at the space, you're looking almost over it, aren't you, to the lake and to the mountains beyond.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And also because the further back you go,
yeah, the more
you see more expensive
view. More expensive view.
Yeah. That's already designed.
Yeah. Just one other question, looking at Lot 4. Question I asked earlier about the relationship with the existing Kanuka on what is the open space zone. Your assessment of it being able to absorb within this landscape or absorb within the area it's sitting in, is that determined, or is that reliant upon that Kanuka staying in perpetuity? If by some other mechanism it was removed, does that absorptive capacity get changed in any way?
Well, I'm not so worried about the vegetation that is to the west of the building, because the visibility that would be opened up through this platform from the west is from viewpoints where you can see really all the peninsula here, and you can see all of Fenland Park. So from those viewpoints that are directly to the west of the site, looking up to the Peninsula Bay area, you see this horizontal band of suburban development. One additional house is going to be practically unnoticeable. So I'm not so worried about vegetation to the direct west of the platform. But having said that, if that vegetation was removed, I'm sure that people in Penrith Park might not like it. I mean, it's my preference for that vegetation to stay. And as I understand it, that vegetation will be within the open space zone and will be on land that ends up being owned by council. So I might say stay.
Decent enough.
Sort of a double check back to this one, plan change 15, that structure plan. So is the division line between the AA5 and AA1 areas, sort of very light yellow and slightly darker yellow,
yep.
Is that roughly again the orange line, is it, the ONL line? Or is there some other purpose going on?
Well, it might be very roughly that line, but really, you should remember that this structure plan was drawn up prior to finding the O&L line anyway.
Yeah, right.
So it probably is roughly there, given that that's the break point.
I think that'd be, yeah. Just to make sure of not missing anything, I talked earlier today, area 3 and 5. I can remember reading that in relation to plan change 25, is that right?
Area 2 and 5.
2 and 5, sorry.
Well, that came from variation 15.
Right.
And again, if you look at that structure plan, I'm not sure I've got the final one here, but there's activity area 5, 5A and 5B was the north end of Peninsula Bay. And activity area 2 was the east.
Oh, I see.
The high east, but it stretches alongside Sticky Forest.
Yes. Yeah.
So those two areas 2 and 5, were sort of talked about as being the most sensitive parts of the site.
Oh, that's the reference, yes, that's right.
But then by the time we moved on to area 25, of course, there were no activity areas or anything. It was just low density residential zone, open space.
And this interestingly shows, of course, a large public park here.
Yes.
Which presumably is not there today. Again, we've moved on since then, but it wasn't one of the ideas, well, you know, rather than have the public park here, let's put it over here.
Yeah, well, at that stage, yes, at that time, that lower land, where that's shown as sort of a lower land of a meltwater channel, that was proposed to be public park. Why or whether that was necessary, I guess it wasn't, because by the time Plan Chapter 25 came along, that wasn't there.
Mm.
Well, it was there, but it was smaller.
It's smaller now, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's what we see on... this one.
Yes, that's right. Sort of that part there. Yeah.
The Central Mount Reserve, the one that linear one, was aligned to follow what's called the Glacial Mount Channel.
Yes.
And that was there's a figure 15 in the variation 25, which is quite useful to refer to where these areas have come from.
So, sort of in I guess, summary, the ONL line, the orange line is, interpretation of that. Okay, I can understand that. There's one small lot, there is one lot within it, but, it's an area where you could say it could absorb change, possibly. And then for the land to the south, or the southwest, whatever you might call it, okay, there may be a bit of an impact there in terms of open space land being replaced with buildings, so that is a sort of a negative, but it's not a big negative. Is that the sort of, in simple terms?
Roughly. I mean, it's roughly. Not enough of a negative to make it offensive to those provisions of the district plan, I believe it's.
Yeah.
It accords with those.
So.
I mean, again, if we go back to that.
It's not so much at this point about the ONL part of the district plan, I guess, is that it's more the general sort of open space and amenity side of the plan, I guess, at this point, wouldn't it?
Yes. If we get down to that level, I guess I'm saying, well, there's going to be a change in character.
Yeah.
And if we just look at the actual space itself, that change in character can be quite substantial.
Mm.
And if we look at it in the big picture in terms of the moraine that surrounds Monaco and that sort of thing,
yeah,
the character change is going to be pretty minor.
Right. Well, the only question is just these little short breaks, and maybe we should just wait a couple of minutes for that.
Yeah.
Now we get back. Sorry about that.
Yes, I guess I was saying the landscape character change that I was talking about there, if we look at the actual space in which it will occur, it'll be a relatively substantial change. But then, in terms of the scale of that effect, I'm saying, look at the big picture of Wanaka or the landforms that surround Wanaka. It's a really very minor change in terms of character. And then if we move on to visual effects, again, because it's been configured in such a way that there's really no visibility from the north, the visual effects have been contained to a very small zone of influence as well.
Okay, sorry, I'm just sort of having a quick look again and read through. I guess it's just paragraphs 31 and 32. Yeah, but I guess, more about 36, that's right. Kind of talked about the urban edges. So you're saying there's still going to be a defined edge, of course, it just moves border change.
Yes, yeah. I mean, looking at those policies there, policy 7.1.2, I mean, obviously they're seeking to keep a defined edge to urban areas. These obviously are not now talking about specifically landscape effects as far as views or anything like that.
That's right.
I think we're meeting those. We're just moving slightly. It could have been drawn in that. Yeah, it could have been done that way and comply with those. You're not breaching anything there.
Just on urban, you're involved with this from early on. If you look at the council material that shows an urban boundary for Wanaka, it doesn't involve this at all, but the outside.
Well, the urban growth boundary, the development that will be enabled by this will be inside the urban growth boundary.
Yeah, that's
right. Yes, it doesn't touch that or extend that. Yeah. So. Obviously, that's important to these policies.
But presumably, there's other areas of open space within that urban growth boundary. I mean, sort of a big thing which then encapsulates a number of different land uses, which includes open space areas. And,
yes, that's right. Yeah.
A lot of it's still grown. Yes, so rural.
Yeah.
Yes.
Inside the urban. Yeah, that was it. In the court's decision, this is on page 15,
And it's that sort of, I don't have it in front of you, but it was in the section 42A material. And it has a paragraph there which is the findings. In summary, we find that the northern part of the site beyond the ridge above the lake is correctly classified O and L, so that's the, you know, that's right. And the rest of the site is correctly classified VAL, which I think is visual amenity landscape or something. Which, I don't really understand the plan and those differences, but it sounds like that's sort of a step back from being, it's not outstanding natural landscape, but it's still got some value.
That's right.
Yes.
That's correct, yeah. At that stage, it was all rural general zone, of course.
Yes.
So, in the rural general zone, it was outstanding natural landscape, visual amenity landscape, and then other rural landscape, which is the third category.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. So land that was generally had a pastoral sort of land use was generally categorised as visual amenity landscape, but it wasn't open now. So, examining the site as it was prior to variation 15.
Okay, right.
The witnesses agreed that, this is a site in which there is a line. One side of the line is going to be O&L, the other side of the line is going to be VAL.
Yeah. Just on that, reading through Ms. Stevens' evidence again, she seems to be saying that the part of the land that she thinks should be included now within the O&L was part of the original visual amenity landscape, but it's now effectively left over because the rest of it's gone to low density residential, so it's a small pocket of what was VAL. So her view is that it's got more in common with the O&L on the northern side than it does with the suburban landscape. In your experience, when there is development and you've got little bits of land that are effectively left over, would you normally just tack that onto the adjacent landscape classification?
Well, not necessarily, no. Often that land ends up being other rural landscape.
Yeah.
There's been quite a few cases around the district where we're dealing with a sort of, something called a remnant bit of rural zone. Franklin Flats and places like this have got it. And those remnant bits have been categorised as other rural landscape.
So I guess the landscape character of a piece of land doesn't necessarily change because the land to which it was formerly part has been developed for different purposes.
Yeah, that's
sort of the right, I think. Yeah, no, it's probably the best way to word it, but that's the point.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the testing. Thanks for the evidence.
Particularly, if you look at the plan, the area encompassed by lots 1 through to 12, that's pretty much all we've got up for us in there. I consider that the areas of indigenous vegetation are significant at the local or ecological district scale. As an exception, since there's been substantial changes to the proposal since the application was lodged, I visited the site again on the 5th of August and confirmed and had surveyed the extent of tussock vegetation, and that comes from this table which we've been given. Previously, my previous survey I've relied on lines hand drawn on a map, but on this particular instance it was surveyed by a survey of Comparison Pits who assisted me. And we were particularly interested in the tussock vegetation. I've relied on the aerial photos for the extent of carnage. It's visually easy to distinguish that. There are the exotic grassland and the tussock grassland essentially look the same. So on the basis of the revised proposal and the site visit, I prepared Table 1 to assist you, which replaces the area estimates presented in my written evidence. Table 1 details at a very fine scale the amount of vegetation to be removed, retained or enhanced, and established by planting as a result of the proposed plan change. So as a result of that, I wish to make some amendments to the figures in my evidence as a result of that recalculation. So if I take you to those now, the first is paragraph 7C. Development across the site may require the removal of up to approximately 1.1 hectares, or 11,335 square metres, should replace those first two numbers, of carnivorous shrubland and depleted tussock grassland. If we move on to D, immediately underneath, just under half of the carnivorous shrubland will be retained, and there will be no new loss of the tussock grassland on the site. I think it's 47% of the carnivorous shrubland, but I'll refer to that later. Paragraph 49. There will be no net loss of tussock grassland at around half, 47% of the carnivorous shrubland on site. Move to paragraph 52, the third to last line. That sentence begins with the recent amendments to the proposal. The amount of permits proposed has been reduced to approximately 11,335 square metres, or 1.1 hectare. But the amount of planting proposed has increased to approximately 2.5 hectare. Just a couple more. If we move to paragraph 75, the last sentence of that paragraph, the extent of the plan change site has now been reduced to approximately 4.37 hectares and only approximately 1.1 hectares of vegetation will be removed. And then finally in paragraph 77, after considering the loss of approximately 1.1 hectares of indigenous vegetation, and so on, the rest of it remains. So as I said, when I first mapped the vegetation, I relied on hand-drawn lines on a map. When we remapped it on Friday, I was a little more conservative in what I considered to be tussock grassland, so I included areas of quite sparse vegetation that I didn't include the first time, and I'll talk to that again in a moment. But basically, when we recalculated the figure, we came up with a slight shortfall in the amount of tussock grassland to achieve a no-net loss, and that's quite easily addressed by expanding the area marked in yellow as RVG2. And so that blue hand-drawn line is where that tussock grassland planting would be extended to. And it would be a gain of approximately 230 square metres. So that would take the numbers to the right of Infinity Drive in that picture, the revegetation area size that's assumed corrections to it. If we were to make that change, that would take the extent of RVE4 down by 230 square metres, which would be 4,895 square metres, and it would increase RVG2 from 1,750 to 1,980 square metres. Vegetation quality varies across the site, particularly with respect to the tussock grassland. And as I said before, when I visited the site to confirm the areas of tussock, I included most of the vegetation in that very poor quality. And I'll just talk to that a bit more. The best quality example of tussock grassland is actually in this area here, which is outside the area proposed for development. There's a small area here in the back of Lot 12, in that area there, which would also be outside the area expected by the development, although it's got that track through it, and there's a track there. That's of sort of moderate quality, I guess you could say. If you were to strictly apply the definition of tussock grassland, all this area down in here would also be considered tussock grassland. But there's hardly any tussock there, and it's mostly hawkweed and bed soil, so I didn't include that in my estimate, even though technically it would meet the definition. Up through this area here, 15-16, the tussocks in that area are very sparse, and I didn't include them in my original estimate. Probably a density of native species of probably 1 to 4 square metres, or perhaps 6 square metres. And so the quality varies considerably over the tussock grasses that remain here. This area up in here, where some of the proposed revegetation is, that has quite sparse native presence, a bit of their soil, quite a bit of their rock grass, so there's potential. And again, down in this area around 19, that's also quite far. So the estimates of vegetation clearance that I've provided in Table 1 include clearance for the building platforms, fences, roads, biking and walking tracks, which were also not included in my first estimate. So on that basis, they're more conservative than the estimates I initially made. As a result of the proposal, and as can be seen in Table 1, a total of 11,335 square metres of vegetation would be removed, and 7,780 square metres of vegetation would be retained and enhanced within the area affected by the plan change. Planting would also replace an area which is currently exotic grassland, and that area that's marked as RVG1 and RVG2 on the landscape concept plan. In all, planting would cover 24,795 square metres, or approximately 2.5 hectares, which is also approximately twice as much as the area removed. The overall result will be a net gain in the extent of indigenous vegetation of 5,680 square metres, and that compares with Ms Palmer's estimate of an overall loss of approximately 4,600 square metres. As I said, the new planting would be concentrated in an area which is currently dominated by exotic grassland and was occupied by lots 5 and 6 in the original proposal. And the location of those is shown in that landscape. I describe in my evidence the reasons why, in my view, pre-human vegetation on the site would have been a mosaic of mountain, beech and mixed broadleaf species, including Hanuka and Kōwhai. I consider it unlikely that the current vegetation mix would be maintained in the longer term without management. Tussock grassland in particular is unlikely to be self-sustaining because of the small size of the area, the ongoing invasion of Hanuka from the adjacent shrubland, the distance from the nearest similar vegetation, the currently degraded state, including the continued browsing by rabbits and hares, the existing thatch of exotic grasses, particularly brown top, and chronic adverse impacts on the low-growing vegetation, including trampling and damage by recreation and use in the set. I consider it most likely that if left, the Kanuka shrubland would develop across the whole site in the medium to longer term, and I consider significant management input is going to be required to avoid that outcome. And I note in her evidence that Ms Stevens identifies that similar type of vegetation used to exist at Mount Iron, but it's now no longer there. And I suspect that because of similar pressures to those at the site we're talking about here. The proposed planting has been designed to maximise the ecological benefits, and the amended version includes additional areas of tussock grassland, which I referred to before, to address some of the matters raised by Ms Palmer in her advice to the Queenstown Lakes District Council. In the most recent amendments to the plan, the cushion pimelia has been added to the species list of tussock grassland. My recommendation is that the prostrate group bluegrass be added to that list and that those changes be carried over to the structure plan. And there's a couple of minor errors in that plan as well, which the spelling mistakes and things like that, which have been originally made it through and will be corrected. Ms Stevens has also identified the presence of Raulia bovidii, which is a scab weed. They have a conservation ranking of naturally uncommon, and that could also be included in the concept plan. It's naturally uncommon in the conservation ranking that's given to things that are thought to be uncommon, not as a result of human activity, but just as a result of the type of plant they are. Or type of species they are. And that particular scab weed occurs in 6 or 7 places throughout the Queenstown Lakes District surrounding Wananga. And that's thought to be its natural distribution. So in relation to the ecological effects of the proposal, there are two aspects to consider. Firstly, the adverse effects of the proposal, which are primarily about vegetation removal. And secondly, the positive effects of the revegetation. With respect to area, the effects are summarised in Table 1. In terms of ecological quality, the overall benefits of the enhancement planting proposed include a substantial increase in the area of Kanuka shrubland, no loss of tussock area, an increase in the quality of habitats, including increased diversity of both plant species and habitats present, and a reduction of weeds and bare soil in the tussock area, the opportunity to include threatened and at-risk plants to assist in their conservation, improved ecological connection between the habitat, particularly the shrublands or landscape scale, enhanced ecological function with respect to buffering of habitat, seed dispersal, successional progress and seasonal food sources, reduced edge effects and improved ecotone quality, contribution to improved ecological integrity, and finally another outcome of the increase in the amount of shrubland vegetation is that once established, shrubland would be less likely to support populations of rabbits and hares at levels that would require management. Shrubland are not a preferred habitat. So, by way of summary, the recent amendments to the proposal have changed the amount of clearance proposed to approximately 1.1 hectare. Overall, there will be no net removal of tussock and a net gain in the area of shrubland. Without derogating my previous opinion expressed in my evidence that shrubland is appropriate, the amended proposal includes a greater area of tussock grassland than originally proposed, and the quality of both tussock and shrubland habitats will be improved by the proposal. In addition to estimates of area, another relevant consideration in the estimate of overall ecological gain is the quality of the habitat. The enhancement planting would include expanding, connecting and enhancing existing habitats at the site. In addition, wilding trees, pine trees, sedasuga trees and broom would be removed. The new planting would result in a significantly increased area of indigenous vegetation and improved ecological integrity, diversity, function and connection between patches of habitat. Overall, I consider that the proposal will improve diversity, sustainability, resilience, connectivity of shrubland in the area, ecological integrity, which is improved by adding species historically present at the site but now absent, and I remain of the opinion that there are net ecological benefits from the proposal. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get my head around. You're proposing sort of forest tree type replacement without the beach?
Yes. Shrubland forest, yeah.
Well, it's compatible with the lots of Kanuka.
Kanuka, Kulfai, Halls Totra, Mountain Beach, those types of species. Well, also with a bit of an increase in the diversity of fruiting species. So, wine variant. My research into what the vegetation historically was like is detailed in paragraph 19 through to 22 of my evidence. Particularly based on the late Dr. Peter Wardle did a lot of research in this area, and he published what is still a student textbook for vegetation in New Zealand. And he was of the opinion that the lowland areas around Lake Wanaka and Wapiti both would have been forested. And he looked for a variety of strands of evidence to support that, some of which he found and some of which he didn't. But the evidence that he didn't find in the form of charcoal and stumps and things, his line of reasoning was that though that source of evidence had disappeared because of the frequency and intensity of fires during the past 12,000 years, particularly since human arrival. Those early hot and intense fires changed the vegetation to a tussock grassland, which was of the type with grey shrubland and monster, which was the type of vegetation at the time you were being derived.
Not being expert in the area and people like the councils in their position seem to be saying should be sticking with what it is, so we need two different propositions.
I think part of
ecology of the area.
Yeah, part of the reason why I think that shrubland is a more sustainable outcome is for the reasons I've talked about earlier. There's a lot of pressure on tussock grasslands from rabbits, from cyclists, from walkers, all those, and they're kind of concentrated in the area that we're talking about here. If you look at what's naturally happening around the shores of Wanaka, Lake Wanaka, even though there is more rainfall as you head further north, it generally is reducing to forest. And, you know, Wardle and there's a whole list of others in my evidence they think that that's a natural phenomenon, that forest is what was here. And I agree with the council's advisor that Tuffet grass is a very threatened environment and one that we should be concerned about. But I think there's other factors to consider at this site, like how sustainable it actually is to maintain such a small area of tussock so far removed from other areas of tussock, in the face of all pressures that we can't necessarily control in a residential, you know, immediately adjacent to a residential area. So for that reason, so as well as it being historically the vegetation type that I would expect to find in this area, I think there's other relevant considerations as to why a change in vegetation would be more desirable. Okay.
Any other questions?
But the current proposal does include substantially more tussock than the notified version to address some of the concerns raised by Ms. Palmer and others in the advice to the council.
Thanks for the updated table, that's very helpful, thank you. Top of the head sort of comment, very blunt comment, 5,680 square metres of additional gain, doesn't sound like much.
It's not a big site though.
Yes.
In the context of a site that's only a bit more than 4 hectares, that's only 40,000 square metres.
Hmm.
There's a limit to what you can do in a small site.
Yeah.
If it was a 100 hectare site, I'd be looking at a much bigger number.
Right. But there's this big open space reserve land there.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, so that's the 4 hectares is the area that's going to be rezoned.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a bigger area of space land that's all there, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And that includes native vegetation that's not included in these numbers.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, it just appears to me, one way to look at it, of course, is it's 4.5 hectares or whatever it is, 4.3 hectares, which is going to be rezoned. It's kind of the opportunity to the good things you've been talking about, the revegetation enhancement, of 4 hectares has been that opportunity to do that, now it gets lost.
Mm.
Yeah. And to a certain extent, what we've got in front of the table is more of a balance rather than an acknowledgement of that lost opportunity, perhaps.
There's a couple of reasons why I think that that's appropriate, and one is that if this was set aside as an ecological reserve,
yes,
I would have an entirely different approach to this. But you've already heard Mr. Boshing and Mr. Greenaway talk about the damage that's going on in the area of the cycling.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to control that at this site. And it is going to be a difficult site to establish vegetation, whether you're trying to establish forest vegetation, as I propose, or whether you're trying to establish tussock vegetation.
Mm.
Either way, it's a difficult site. And so it's going to be a relatively expensive undertaking to try and establish vegetation and get it properly established. So in the face of, you know, all those threats and the cost of actually doing this kind of work,
I think it represents
a pragmatic approach to try and improve what's there. And you know, in my selection of species, I included a range of things that are fruiting species, so they're dispersed by birds.
Yeah.
So the effects of what happens in this area will actually spread, because the birds are flying around spreading seeds.
Right. So on the one hand, there might be an opportunity which has been lost, but on the other hand, there's certainty about an outcome being achieved, which is the 2.5 hectares or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that may have some flow-on benefits in terms of the wider open space area. Yeah. Do they, the areas that are shown for revegetation, a lot of them sort of feel like they're there to more screen houses rather than achieve a sort of ecological outcome.
And that was suggested by some of the people advising the council, and it may even have been raised by submission. That's not necessarily the case. If you look at the area that's labelled RBS1, that's starts at lot 14, goes up around 13, around the back of 20, and then it joins onto that area of Tuckwick and then around the back of 22. Mm. That's really about filling in gaps.
Yes.
And connecting those habitats together. The extent to which we do that, you know, as I've already said, there are reasons why it's going to be an undertaking, and so you could expand that area further, but I think in terms of what you can realistically achieve, that's a good outcome. If you look at the area down to the south behind lots 1 to 12, in some ways that site's easier for establishment of vegetation because you've got essentially a bare slate.
Mm.
But again, it's not going to be an easy site. So on the plan, what's shown is a hard line. What's going to be the reality is it's going to be, I talked about ecotones, which is where you swap from one type of vegetation to another. It's going to be more subtle than it appears on the map.
Yeah.
And the species that go into an ecotone are species that would occur in both types of habitat. And what will happen over time, naturally, is those areas will expand out across and reconnect up. I guess part of my logic in doing this was kind of allowing nature to do what is happening at that site anyway, which I think is tending towards Kānuka shrubland.
Mm-hmm.
But the only reason I think some of these other species are not there is because the seed sources were destroyed so long ago and the nearest seed sources are now so far away that they aren't able to make natural ingress back in here. So by providing them, I would expect that, you know, they are going to move out through this area and they're going to contribute positively to the other habitats around as well. So have I answered your question?
Well, no, it's helpful. I guess the final question I've got, I mean, you mentioned a couple of times, it's going to be quite difficult with this revegetation,
mm-hmm.
And I can appreciate that from being up on the site here.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a 5-year sort of maintenance period, or whatever you might call it. I mean, is that sufficient in given the conditions and to really get them established and get to the point where they sort of, you know, can start to look after themselves?
I think Tuckwick is always going to require maintenance.
Yes.
Because as long as there's rabbits on the site,
right.
They're going to be degrading it, and it's going to be a challenge to maintain that vegetation type without putting some input into it. In terms of shrubland, I think there's a number of things you can do to increase the chances, and I've suggested that they do things like deep irrigation, mulching, addition of fertiliser. I don't think I mentioned it specifically, but there are other things you can do, like prune the tops of them so they've got a better root base. And I think if you apply those things, 5 years probably is sufficient to get, and you're also doing rabbit management at the same time,
right.
Rabbit and hare management. 5 years is long enough for them to get up above the point where the hares would be eating them.
Yes.
And what may happen if the rabbit and hare management doesn't continue is you'll get a whole lot of lollipop plants.
Right.
They're chewed up to kind of like 50 centimetres, which is the maximum height a hare can chew to.
Right.
But if your hare and rabbit control is ongoing, there's no reason why that wouldn't, why they wouldn't form normal trees and continue growing their way. I think 5 years is the sufficient to achieve that.
Right. Is that something, I mean, those matters you talked about, the watering, the irrigation, I mean, normally you'd expect those in some sort of management plan, would you?
Yeah.
Sort of details about what actually is going to occur, when, and et cetera.
And the other thing that I think Ms. Palmer raised in her evidence is we haven't talked about proportions of each of these species in the plan. That's another thing that would be included in a management plan for the site. We've got more certainty around how many of each species are going into this area.
Yes.
It's too complicated to be shown in a concept plan, but it'll probably be a 12 or 15 page document which details all the approaches that are required and how to plan them.
Yeah, that was a point I was going to pick up when we get to the planning about is there a need to be referenced to some sort of management plan or something like that in the criteria or whatever it might be, because there seem to be a number of factors like that which don't really come out as rules as such, because it's a management plan that needs to be in place. Okay.
Just one from that, following on from the others, in terms of the canoe that's being removed and replaced.
Yeah.
How long does it take for the canoe in this environment to reach a level where it can survive with unassisted?
Kanuga have the advantage that it's not very tasty.
Yeah.
So here the rabbits won't eat it, and I don't know if you noticed, but there are small Kanuga seedlings out there. I'm not trying to think about that. So it's a bit hard to kind of put a firm number on it, because as soon as I say it'll be established in a year, you'll get a really bad drought in the second year and it'll kill them. And everyone I know that's ever done any planting has some horror story about something that wiped out all their plants in 1 year, which is why it's dangerous. You don't go out and plant everything in 1 year. It's just a recipe for disaster. So, to answer your question, because it's relatively unpalatable, it would establish, I would expect, quite quickly. Yeah.
So that
and it's also that quite resistant to frost. It does get frost damage, but it's relatively resistant.
So
if it makes it through its first summer, it's probably okay.
Okay, so in that case, the 5-year period would be sufficient for canoe as well.
Yeah. Okay.
This may be not a question for you, maybe back to Mr. Espy actually. Particularly that the tussock, the grassland area that's shown, the big revegetation area that's shown, RV. E3 and E4. We were up there this morning. It's quite a hillock, isn't it? Open sort of open terrain at that point. Would a lot of that, the extent to which that revegetation would be visible if you're down on Infinity Drive or more sort of a landscape visual question in a way.
So E3 and E4 are actually proposed to be Kanuga vegetation.
Kanuga, yeah.
It wraps around the grassland area,
yeah,
at the back of lot 4 to 12.
how visible? Yeah. From sort of public, apart from the reserve area, but if you're down on Infinity Drive or sort of wandering around the area, how visible would that revegetation be?
Well, I think that would largely be over the brow of the moraine if you're in Infinity Drive or somewhere to the south. Well, you'd probably see the southernmost part of the E4,
yeah,
which comes up to the brow of the hill. So you see vegetation along the brow of that hill. But I don't think you'd see any of RV G1, G2, or you wouldn't see much of RV E3.
No, but okay, so you might get this impression of the... You obviously got the houses on Affinity Drive at that level. There's the slope up, which will have a row of houses or something. But then behind that will be, some point, some vegetation that will appear above that.
Yes, that southern edge of E4 comes right up onto the brow. So, you see that as a massive, higher shrub vegetation behind the houses.
Yes, yes. Thank you. I think if we take a little break now, that'll be fine. Yeah,
yeah.
We can do the planning.
Yeah,
that'll be great.
Break.
Yeah, good. What about, got to get going at 5 o'clock, because Richard Gazard has got to meet him across the other side of the hill, I think. He said he has to get to.
It's
6. So we just want to get to 5. We'll just see how we go. No need to rush it. I guess we've got tomorrow morning.
We've only got Mr. Taylor's.
So we'll see how we go. Yeah,
we might well be able to
wrap it up today, or if need be, we can just spill over tomorrow a little bit. Yeah. Okay. I don't think we've completely worked out about what we want to do tomorrow morning. I don't think we're too worried about the boat trip.
Okay.
A bit too cold for me on the
trip. No, I've got a spare wetsuit.
Well, I think we satisfied that, given the, you know, the information we've had and the FDSB's, you know, representation of things, understand all that, I think. So
yeah.
I don't think we're going to gain anything from being out in the boat.
Right, yeah.
So I think from that point of view, if we need to finish off your case tomorrow morning, that will work. If not, we'll sort out where we're at in terms of, obviously, this minister started after midday. Yeah. Okay, great. So we'll just take 10-15 minutes.
Thanks.